Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
An estimated 10 million people have fallen through the cracks and are not considered citizens of any country. They are stateless and as such are denied benefits that come with a birth certificate and a nationality.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva on the campaign to end statelessness. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the European Union's Frontex Border Patrol Agency opens its first fast-track migrant registration center on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency says a global 10-year campaign launched 1 year ago to end statelessness is making progress, but not enough. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
An estimated 10 million people have fallen through the cracks and are not considered citizens of any country. They are stateless and as such are denied benefits that come with a birth certificate and a nationality. The UN Refugee Agency reports a child is born stateless at least every 10 minutes. Assistant High Commissioner for Protection Volker Turk tells VOA, a stateless child will grow up with his or her aspirations for a meaningful life frustrated. He says statelessness takes a serious psychological toll and undermines a child's esteem.
They are trapped in a bit of a vicious circle because they compare obviously themselves with others and they don't understand why is it that the person who looks just like me is a national, can go to schooling without problems, can go to healthcare services without problems, and I can't. What's different?
The UNHCR reports stateless young people also face discrimination, stigmatization, and harassment, and are more vulnerable to exploitation. Statelessness exists on all continents. People sometimes become stateless when a country dissolves, as happened in the former Soviet Union, or when a new country is born, such as South Sudan. Gender discrimination also plays a role. Many states do not allow a mother to confer her nationality upon her child. Volker Turk says statelessness can be resolved.
For instance, in Cote d'Ivoire, in the Ivory Coast, you had a statelessness problem in the past, which was resolved through the adoption of a nationality law. So it also shows if you have an interest and a political will, you can actually resolve them by granting nationality to people who have been habitually resident in that country for a long time.
The UNHCR urges all states to ensure universal birth registration to allow mothers to pass on their nationality to their children and eliminate laws that deny children nationality because of their ethnicity, race, or religion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union's Frontex Border Patrol Agency has opened its first fast-track migrant registration center on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea. More than 3,000 migrants have arrived on the small Greek island this year. Most have arrived in the last 6 weeks, tripling the island's population. Frontex provides provisional travel visas to migrants who register on the Frontex database. More centers will be opened in Greece and Italy, another frontline migrant destination. Migrant traffic from Turkey to Greece has surpassed earlier routes from Libya across the Mediterranean to Italy. The International Office for Migration says Aegean Sea crossings from Turkey to Greece have declined over the last 4 days because of rough weather. IOM officials say a strike by maritime workers will lower the number even more. IOM estimates October crossings reached 200,000, an all-time high for the year. Deaths at sea have also risen in 7 fatal shipwrecks. The Hellenic Coast Guard recovered 106 bodies, but many more have been reported missing. The deadliest incident was off the coast of Lesbos on October 28th, when 42 bodies were recovered and 274 migrants were rescued. Serbia and Croatia have launched a direct train transfer of migrants, so asylum seekers don't have to stand in the cold for long hours waiting for the next train to Europe. The first train carrying about 1,000 migrants left today from the Serbian town of Sid for Slavonski Brod, Croatia, where authorities have set up a winter camp for migrants.
Despite South Africa being at the center of the HIV/AIDS epidemic since the beginning, the disease is still underreported as an official cause of death. In fact, new estimates say 93% of AIDS deaths are wrongly attributed to other causes. Researchers say that's hindering efforts to monitor the country's HIV control programs. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The International AIDS Society says the good news is AIDS mortality in South Africa peaked in 2007. It's been declining with the introduction of antiretroviral therapy. The bad news is, despite the decline, HIV remains the leading cause of death. Dr. Debbie Bradshaw is director of the Burden of Disease Research Unit at the South African Medical Research Council. She and her colleagues took a close look at the official mortality figures from 1997 to 2010.
My team has been working on this for the last 15 years or so, as we saw the emergence of the AIDS epidemic. Around the year 2000, we realized the prevalence of HIV was increasing rapidly, and the death statistics produced in the country were not showing AIDS as a cause of death because it was not being reported.
In the year 2000, when South Africa hosted the world's largest AIDS conference, then-President Thabo Mbeki refused to acknowledge a virus was the cause. Hundreds of scientists and others signed the Durban Declaration, criticizing his stand.
There was also quite a political challenge at that point, with the AIDS dissidents starting to become vocal and creating confusion. So we were quite determined to try and understand if HIV was having an impact on mortality. So we set up this system of tracking numbers, really focusing on the age at which the deaths were occurring.
Bradshaw and her team track the causes of death listed for specific age groups that typically would be affected by HIV. The official cause of death for many was attributed to ill-defined natural causes, along with tuberculosis, diarrhea, meningitis, or respiratory infections. The study found these were pseudonyms for HIV/AIDS.
Without treatment, these causes were ending up being fatal.
Bradshaw says while denial has declined, there continues to be a great deal of stigma in South Africa surrounding HIV/AIDS.
There's a huge unwillingness to talk about HIV. Doctors are not keen to write it on the death notification forms. You know, it's left a huge mark that people don't want to talk about it.
Stigma has major consequences for preventing infections and treating those already infected.
We are very concerned because unless we can really track what's going on and know whether the treatment is making a difference and know whether the incidence is coming down, it makes it really difficult to respond to the epidemic.
Bradshaw says it's disappointing that despite government rollout of antiretroviral drugs around 2006, it did not become more acceptable to acknowledge the disease. At the height of the epidemic, it's estimated there were 700 AIDS deaths each day. Bradshaw says that figure was around 560 per day in 2010, and has declined further since then. However, she adds, it's still a sizable number. Also, while the mortality rate is declining, many people continue to be infected, keeping the epidemic alive.
It's difficult to measure the rate, but at least 1-2% of the population is getting infected each year, and that's just not going to help us get rid of the epidemic.
It's estimated that 12% of South Africa's population, about 53 million, is infected with HIV. Bradshaw estimates there were nearly 3 million deaths from AIDS in South Africa by 2010. She says had antiretrovirals been introduced much sooner, about 1 million lives could have been saved. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Burundi, police say at least 9 people have died in gunfights with security forces since Saturday. The Associated Press says President Pierre Nkurunziza yesterday set a 5-day deadline for civilians to turn in any illegal weapons. He said police should use all means necessary to stop the ongoing violence. Well over 100 people have died in violence in Burundi since April. That's when the president announced he would seek another term in office. His opponents say that violated the Constitution's 2-term limit.
Amnesty International and the Center for Environment, Human Rights and Development in Nigeria say multinational oil company Shell has not cleaned up 4 oil spill sites in the Niger Delta, as the company claims. Chris Stein reports from Accra.
Oil pollution in the Ogoniland region of the Niger Delta is so severe, the UN Environmental Program said in a 2011 study, it will take decades to clean up. Amnesty International says it found visible pollution at 4 oil spill sites there it says Shell claimed to have cleaned up years ago. Mark Dumet is the business and human rights researcher at Amnesty.
There were leaks, spills, in one case dating back to 1970, which has still not been cleaned up.
Shell was forced to stop extracting oil from Ogoniland in 1993 because of protests by local communities who said the drilling was causing too much pollution, but its pipelines still cross the region. Of the 4 sites Amnesty investigated, 2 of the spills happened in Ogoniland in 2008 and 2009. In a statement Tuesday, Shell said widespread theft and illegal refining of crude oil continue to cause new spills. Shell said it is committed to cleaning up all spills from its facilities, irrespective of cause. On its website, Shell says it has cleaned up all the sites in Ogoniland that were identified by the United Nations as polluted by its activities. Amnesty's Dumet says many people there cannot work because oil slicks have destroyed the fisheries and farmland the communities rely on for their livelihood. Dumet said Shell is not the only one to blame for the lack of cleanup. He also took Nigeria's oil spill regulators to task.
One of the problems, or one of the things that we found at 3 of the 4 sites that we investigated, was that government regulators had actually certified the Shell cleanup, meaning they had ticked them, they'd approved them. They said, yes, Shell, you have cleaned them up to the regulatory standard.
A spokesman for the National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency was not available for comment. Chris Stein for VOA News, Accra.
Reuters news agency says 3 journalists from Zimbabwe's state-owned newspaper have been charged with publishing false stories after claiming a police commissioner and other government workers are involved in a series of recent elephant poisonings. The Sunday Mail's editor, Mambasa Sasa, and 2 reporters were arrested yesterday. They are being held at a police station in Harare. They reported that an unnamed police commissioner, several policemen, and park rangers are under investigation for allegedly being part of a poaching syndicate. The remains of about 60 elephants were found in Hwange National Park in the last month. A police spokesperson says they have recovered 70 tusks and 110 kilograms of cyanide and arrested several suspects. But she denied any investigation of police involvement. She asked that the reporters identify officials allegedly involved. The newspaper's owners say they will issue a statement today. The 3 journalists are to appear in court tomorrow to answer the charges.
Authorities fighting wildlife poaching and trafficking have a new ally on their side, the Internet. The National Whistleblower Center has launched a campaign to protect wildlife crime whistleblowers. The secure online reporting site will encourage whistleblowers to expose wildlife trafficking and other crimes that endanger wildlife and the environment. It will also educate whistleblowers globally on how the wildlife whistleblower laws work. The secured Internet Wildlife Crime Reporting System is spearheaded by Stephen Cohn, director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C. He says the program will protect people who have the courage to step forward to save wildlife.
The online system will be a method in which any whistleblower worldwide can send in confidentially a report about a wildlife crime. And it will have two levels of confidentiality. First, technological, and second, attorney-client. The program will be managed by attorneys with the whistleblower's best interest in mind.
So how will it work? They will be able to just log into the system and put the information in there, and then they are ensured that it will remain confidential and private?
That's right. And if they go to globalwhistleblower.org right now, the first draft of this online program is up. We would recommend that people use it not from their home computer or from a work computer, but go to someplace where it can't be tracked back. The final version will be multilingual and fully secure with the highest levels of security. But from our perspective, the attorney-client privilege is critical because it creates a legal confidentiality. If a whistleblower goes to a journalist or to an NGO or to even a governmental agency, they're not guaranteed confidentiality. But if they come to a program that's managed by attorneys, by law, in the United States and almost every other country, they're entitled to confidentiality. So that gets you a level of protection that is unavailable in almost all other reporting structures.
How else will they be protected, especially since this is coming from anywhere in the world?
What's happening is there's been a new development in U.S. whistleblower laws. First, under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which we're extensively using. And over 1,500 international whistleblowers have now used this program, and they've obtained over $30 million in financial rewards already. The way it works is the whistleblower comes in confidentially through a legal organization and gives the information about the violations to the appropriate law enforcement agency, and that's done through us because we know where the information needs to go. And if there's an enforcement action, the whistleblower is entitled to a monetary reward that can be very large. So the whistleblower never identifies himself to their employer, to their local government, to anybody. They collect the information, they bring it forward. It's really up to the lawyer to work with the whistleblower to make sure that the information given doesn't reveal their identity, and then you hope that it translates into a successful enforcement action. And what we've learned from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, from major international banking cases, from government contracting cases, we've learned that these whistleblowers are the number one source of fraud detection. In other words, they're the insiders with the information. It's essentially, you have the whistleblower on the one hand, you have the governmental organization that needs the information to enforce the law on the other hand, and then we're going to have this reporting structure right in the middle that permits the whistleblower to come forward confidentially, have their information vetted, protected, put together in a proper fashion, and then given to the appropriate law enforcement agency. Given the amount of illegal trafficking in wildlife, the fact that billions does enter the United States, that the UN has estimated the worldwide trade is about $200 billion, and given the very broad scope of some of the U.S. laws, especially the Lacey Act, that broadly prohibits all trafficking in illegal wildlife, that includes fish, plants, and animals. So if someone's doing illegal logging, that counts. We think this program will be spectacularly successful.
That was Stephen Cohn, director of the National Whistleblower Center. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C., and says those who want to report wildlife crime should visit their website at www.globalwhistleblower.org.
A senior U.S. military official said the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate whenever and wherever international law allows, including the South China Sea. The remarks by U.S. Pacific Command Commander Admiral Harry Harris follows a media report that the U.S. Navy plans to conduct regular patrols near contested islands claimed by China. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
Speaking at the Stanford Center at Peking University in the Chinese capital, Harris said international seas and airspace belong to everyone, and the U.S. military will continue to operate whenever and wherever international law allows. He said the South China Sea is no exception. His remarks follow last week's mission by the guided missile destroyer USS Lawson to sail within 12 nautical miles of an artificial island constructed by China in the contested Spratly Islands. It was seen as a direct challenge to China, which lodged a protest with the U.S. ambassador. Last week, China's top naval official criticized the patrol as dangerous and provocative, and one that could spark a conflict. Harris, in Beijing for talks with his Chinese counterpart, said such routine operations should never be construed as a threat to any nation, but serve to protect the rights, freedoms, and lawful use of the sea and airspace guaranteed to all nations. He restated U.S. policy that Washington takes no position on competing claims to land features in the South China Sea. China claims sovereignty over most of the vital waterway, a claim Harris called ambiguous. During talks in Seoul Monday with Defense Secretary Ash Carter, South Korea's defense minister said the South China Sea is important to his country as it ships a third of its exports and most of its imports and energy across the waterway. He said freedom of navigation and flight should be ensured and called for early agreement on a code of conduct. Reuters quotes a U.S. Navy official as saying the U.S. plans to conduct regular patrols on contested waters about twice a quarter or a little more than that. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said that's the right amount to make it regular but not a constant poke in the eye. Deputy U.S. National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, speaking at a defense summit in Washington Monday, said much the same thing.
There will be more demonstrations of our commitment to freedom of navigation. That's our interest there. It's not to say that one country has an appropriate claim and another doesn't. It's to demonstrate that we will uphold the principle of freedom of navigation.
Rhodes said the goal is to have a diplomatic and multilateral framework to resolve the issue.
One, so that you have a code of conduct between China and the ASEAN, Southeast Asian countries, to avoid inadvertent escalation, to have dialogue. And two, that you move these disputes over territory into international forums that can resolve maritime claims.
Asked if such patrols run the risk of a confrontation with China, Rhodes acknowledges it is a balancing act.
Again, we have to demonstrate our commitment to certain international principles. We have to demonstrate in this part of the world you're not just going to have a situation where a bigger nation can bully a smaller nation on an issue like a territorial claim. On the other hand, you don't want to provoke conflict yourself.
Rhodes described the U.S. approach as very deliberate, measured, and transparent. Both he and Harris emphasized the need for continued dialogue with Chinese officials. Security analyst Denny Roy of the Hawaii-based East-West Institute acknowledges finding the right balance for such U.S. patrols will not be easy.
Any response at all on the part of the United States will anger the Chinese, of course. Any gestures beyond zero have a cost to pay in U.S.-China relations. But at the same time, too light of a response on the part of the United States maybe shakes the confidence of U.S. friends and allies that the United States is fully committed to backing up the international system in the region. The best possibility here is that both sides become accustomed to an ongoing arrangement. The visits are handled about the same way by both sides each time, and we can get a stabilization effect similar to what took place during the Cold War when the United States and the Soviet Union played these sorts of games.
Roy says such missions carry the risk of miscalculation and a potential loss of life, but adds that the risk of non-action is also high. He says the hope remains that both sides will seek restraint, since neither wants an incident. Roy also sees that situation as a victory for China as it continues to modestly increase its strategic presence in the region. He says U.S. patrols won't change the fact that China's claims are unlikely to be reversed. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the secrets of doing business in Africa
from an American corporate executive's perspective. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they share how U.S. companies can best play catch-up with the fastest-growing continent. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.